kitchen hall and I'm really doing it. Whatever comes up in my mind, it feels like I'm right there with it. At times, I still find myself looking forward to the session ending, but when those thoughts come up, I just note them and move on. It's like a curtain has been lifted. It's not that anything in the passing show is so amazing in itself. It's the sheer rapidity of it all. The objects arising and passing, ricocheting off one another with such speed. And there's something about the act of being present and awake in this way that produces a gigantic blast of serotonin. Hands feel stiff, bird, feet numb, images of all those creepy baby faces in Renaissance art, heart pounding, back, bird, hands, feet, heart, back, 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 feet, bird, 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 feet, hands, feet, 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 hands, hands, back, 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 heart, bird, feet, feet, bird, feet, bird, feet, bird, back, feet, 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 heart, bird, bird, bird. Old lady in the front row produces an epic burp. It's like I'd spent the past 5 days dragged by my head behind a motorboat and now, all of a sudden, I'm up on water skis. This is an experience of my own mind I've never had before. A front row seat to watch the machinery of consciousness. It's thrilling, but it also produces some very practical insights. I get a real sense of how a few slippery little thoughts I might have in, say, the morning before I go to work, maybe after a quarrel with Bianca, a story I read in the paper, or an imagined dialogue with my boss, can weasel their way into the stream of my mind and pool in unseen eddies from which they hector and haunt me throughout the day. Thoughts calcify into opinions, little seeds of discontent blossom into bad moods, unnoticed back pain makes me inexplicably irritable with anyone who happens to cross my path. I'm remembering that time when my friend Kayama stumped me by asking how anyone could be in the present moment when it's always slipping away. It's so obvious to me now, the slipping away is the whole point. Once you've achieved choiceless awareness, you see so clearly how fleeting everything is. Impermanence is no longer theoretical. Tempus fugit isn't just something you inscribe in books and clocks. And that, I realize, is what this retreat is designed to do. Having been dragged, kicking, and screaming into the present, I'm finally awake enough to see what I could never see in my regular life. Apparently, there's no other way to get here than to engage in the tedious work of watching your breath for days. In a way, it makes sense. How do you learn a sport? You do drills. A language. Conjugate endless verbs. A musical instrument. Scales. All the misery of repetition, the horror of sitting here in this hall with these zombies, suddenly seems totally worth it. Walking meditation is starting to click for me as well. I'm out on the patio in front of the retreat hall, deconstructing every step. Lift, move, place. My feet feel nice on the warm stones. Midway through one of the endless round trips to nowhere, even though it's technically a violation of Goldstein's rule against using walking meditation as recess, I stop and stare at three baby birds perched on the ledge overlooking the courtyard, screeching their heads off as their mom zips to and fro, popping food into their mouths. I'm transfixed. A few other people have joined me, gaping at this little show. I feel incredibly happy, and I keep telling myself not to cling to it. When I walk back into the hall for the next sit, I see Spring up at the altar. Right, it's meta time. I lie down, and we start in, directing the four phrases at ourselves. May you be happy, may you be safe, etc. Then Spring tells us to pick our benefactor. I pick my mother. I summon a mental picture of her from a few weeks ago when she and I were taking care of my 2-year-old niece, Campbell. We had just given Campbell a bath and all three of us were lying on the bed. My mom started singing Campbell's favorite song, M. Ward's For Beginners, which Campbell referred to as the uh-huh song because the chorus included a lot of uh-huhs. I'm able to generate a real felt sense of my mom. I'm enjoying the sweet absurdity of a grandmother having memorized the words to an indie rock song. As I picture her with her neatly coiffed short gray hair and her smart casual clothing, something entirely unexpected overcomes me. A silent sob wells up in my chest with all the inevitability of a sneeze. There's no stopping this. Tears rush down the sides of my recumbent face, streaming down my temples in hot streams that get thicker with each successive wave of emotion. The water is pooling behind my ears. "Now pick a dear friend," says Spring. She's back to using her funny voice, but it's not bothering me at all. I go with Campbell. It couldn't be more convenient. She's already right here in this scene I'm conjuring in such vivid detail. She's propped up against the pillow on the bed. I have one of her little feet in my hand, and I'm looking at her sweet face with her mischievous eyes, which are eagerly lapping up all the attention my mom and I are giving her. I'm crying even harder now. It's not an out loud sobbing, but there's no way the people around me aren't noticing this because I'm sniffing and breathing choppily. The blubbering lasts right up until when the bell rings. As I walk out of the hall, I'm grateful for the rule against eye contact, otherwise this would be very embarrassing. I emerge into the daylight, walk down the hill a ways, and stand in the scrub grass under the warm afternoon sun. Amid the crashing waves of bliss, I feel a gentle undertow of doubt. Is this bullshit or the real deal? Maybe it's just the result of 5 days of unbroken agony, finally relieved. Like that joke where the guy is banging his head against the wall. When asked why he's doing it, he says, "Because it feels so good when I stop." But no, the waves of happiness just keep coming. Everything is so bright, so crisp. I feel great. Not just great, unprecedentedly great. I'm aware of the urge to cling to this feeling, to wring out every last bit of flavor, like with a tangy piece of gum or a tab of ecstasy. But this is not the synthetic, always just about to end buzz of drugs. This is roughly 1,000 times better. It's the best high of my life. My nose is running savagely. I don't have anything to wipe it with. I blow it into my hand and walk, dripping snot, to the nearest bathroom, laughing goofily. I take a run. I've been doing this most afternoons. I've found a little route that goes through an adjacent horse farm and out into the local neighborhood of upper-middle-class homes. I'm still high. As my feet pound, I'm crying, then laughing at myself crying, and then crying some more. I'm wondering whether this is the start of a different way of being in the world for me, one where, as brilliant genius Spring has described, you train yourself to have compassion rather than aversion as your default setting. I'd be loath to call what I'm feeling spiritual or mystical. Those terms connote, to me at least, otherworldliness or unreality. By contrast, what's happening right now feels hyper-real, as if I've been pulled out of a dream rather than thrust into one. After dinner, it's Goldstein giving the Dharma talk. He's making an intriguing point. The Buddha's signature pronouncement, "life is suffering," is the source of a major misunderstanding and, by extension, a major PR problem. It makes Buddhism seem supremely dour. Turns out, though, it's all the result of a translation error. The Pali word dukkha doesn't actually mean suffering. There's no perfect word in English, but it's closer to unsatisfying or stressful. When the Buddha coined his famous phrase, he wasn't saying that all of life is like being chained to a rock and having crows peck out your innards. What he really meant was something like, everything in the world is ultimately unsatisfying and unreliable because it won't last. As Goldstein points out, we don't live our lives as if we recognize the basic facts. How often are we waiting for the next pleasant hit of whatever? The next meal or the next relationship or the next latte or the next vacation? I don't know. We live in anticipation of the next enjoyable thing that we'll experience. I mean, we've been, most of us, incredibly blessed with the number of pleasant experiences we've had in our lives. Yet when we look back, where are they now? It's so strange for me to be sitting and listening to what is essentially a sermon, complete with quotes from a sacred text, and to be genuinely moved. After all those years of being the only non-believer in a room filled with rapt devotees, here I am sitting and taking notes, totally engrossed, nodding my head. I mean, he's so right. In cartoons, when the characters slurp down some delicious food or drink, they smack their lips and seem totally sated. But in the real world, it doesn't work that way. Even if we were handed everything we wanted, would it really make us sustainably happy? How many times have we heard from people who got rich or famous and it wasn't enough? Rock stars with drug problems, lottery winners who kill themselves. There's actually a term for this, hedonic adaptation. When good things happen, we bake them very quickly into our baseline expectations, and yet the primordial void goes unfilled. Goldstein makes clear, as he did the other night, that he's not saying we can't enjoy pleasant things in life, but if we can achieve a deeper understanding of suffering, of the unreliability of everything we experience, it will help us appreciate the inherent poignancy of everything in the world. It's like we've been enchanted, he says. We've been put under a spell, believing that this or that is going to be the source of our ultimate freedom or happiness. And to wake up from that, to wake up from that enchantment, to be more aligned with what is true, it brings us much greater happiness. On retreat, with nothing to look forward to, nowhere to be, nothing to do, we are forced to confront the wound of existence head on, to stare into the abyss and realize that so much of what we do in life, every shift in our seat, every bite of food, every pleasant daydream, is designed to avoid pain or seek pleasure. But if we can drop all that, we can, as Sam once said in his speech to the angry, befuddled atheists, learn how to be happy before anything happens. This happiness is self-generated, not contingent on exogenous forces. It's the opposite of suffering. What the Buddha recognized was a genuine game changer. After the final meditation of the night, as I leave the hall, I turn around toward the Buddha, and I can't believe I'm doing this. I bow. Day 6. I wake up, and the world is still magical. I'm becoming almost frighteningly alert. My senses are heightened, like in the movies when a mortal starts turning into a vampire. After breakfast, as I walk back up the hill, I can hear the mice scurrying underneath the brush alongside the path. I have a freakish attunement to the communications within the hidden society of birds in the trees. Meditation is still easy. I start by doing a round of breath focus, which is like filling a hot air balloon. Once the mind is fully inflated with concentration, I just let it fly into choiceless awareness. Urge to scratch. Image of a row of baboons sitting on bales of hay. Thought of the illicit apple I'm hiding in my room. Even bad stuff doesn't seem to really get to me. I can feel myself playing with the cape of pain draped over my back. I'm investigating it without letting it truly bother me. At lunch, I realize I've now become one of these people who chews with his eyes shut. Eating mindfully, I actually put the fork down between bites rather than hunting around the plate while I'm still swallowing. As a result, I stop eating when I'm full, as opposed to stuffing my face until I'm nearly sick, as I usually do. I spot a guy on the other side of the room who seems to be enjoying his meal immensely. I experience a sudden upsurge of what the Buddhists call mudita, sympathetic joy. It's so strong, I almost start blubbering again. It happens once more when I look up and see three women helping one another get the remaining chai out of the big metal pot in which it's served. This tableau of silent, awkward, eyes-averted cooperation fills my eyes to the rim. But then, as quickly as it came, the rapture evaporates. The afternoon meditation session is a humbling reversion. Sleep beckons with the unwanted seductiveness of a clingy ex-girlfriend. At times, I nod off for a nanosecond and then come to with what feels like a jackhammer to the head. At the end of 45 minutes, I have a massive headache. It's official. The magic is gone. The afternoon metta session leaves me cold. During the last sitting of the day, I am hit with a sickening jolt of restless energy so strong that it feels as if it might leave my limbs palsied. It gets so bad that I do the heretofore unthinkable. I resort to the one measure that, despite all the preceding difficulties, I have not yet employed. I give up. I open my eyes and sit in the hall looking around guiltily. Day 7. Now I'm back to counting the days until I can leave. The thought crosses my mind that maybe I've gotten all I'm going to get out of this experience. I'm still bowing to the Buddha, but mostly for the hamstring stretch. Day 8. I'm on the schedule to see Goldstein this morning. I arrive full of piss and vinegar. He'll be the first person I tell about my meditative attainments. I practically bound to my seat and give him a full report on my breakthrough, the choiceless awareness, the hummingbird, the metta-induced weeping. I don't know what I'm expecting. Applause, maybe? As it turns out, he's pretty much unimpressed. He smiles and gently tells me he's heard this story a million times. This is like First Retreat 101. I thought I'd achieved a front row seat in the theater of my mind. He makes it clear that I really had loge seating. As you continue your practice, he says, your NPMs, noticings per minute, will go way up. Then I tell him about the horrific jolt of restlessness from the night before last. Again, his response is, nothing special, happens all the time. He is massively reassuring, though, on the inevitable vexations and vicissitudes of the practice. It is, he says, not unusual at all to go from bliss to misery within the space of an hour. He assures me that as I get more advanced, the ups and downs won't be so jagged. I get up to leave, comforted by the knowledge that I am walking a well-trodden path. People have been doing this practice for 2,500 years. On my way to the door, he shouts after me and says, I'm moving too fast. You're not being mindful enough, he says. Like a sports coach, he exhorts me to up my game, to pay more attention as I do things like walk and open doors. This is the stuff. I wonder, is my growing reverence for Goldstein a form of Stockholm syndrome, or is this person genuinely special? As I stand outside the office, soaking up the sunshine for a moment, the hummingbird reappears. An hour or so later, in the morning question and answer period, a brassy red-headed woman in the front row asks the question that's been nagging at me this whole time. If enlightenment is real, where are all the enlightened people? It gets a good laugh, including from Goldstein, who promises that at tonight's Dharma talk, he's gonna explain everything. This I'm looking forward to. During the course of this retreat, he has repeatedly dropped words like liberation, awakening, and realization. But is this vaunted transformation actually achievable? If so, how? And what does it look like? In the Buddhist scriptures, people are getting enlightened left and right. They're dropping like flies, even seven-year-olds. The Buddha had an entire lexicon to describe enlightenment. The true, the beyond, the very hard to see, the wonderful, the marvelous, the island, and more. All those words, and I still had no idea what he meant. At 7 o'clock, it's time for the big show. We're all assembled in the hall. Goldstein is finally going to explain enlightenment. He starts by acknowledging that for householders, non-monks, the idea of an end to craving can seem unattainable. Can we even imagine a mind free of craving? I think most of us resonate probably more closely with the famous prayer of St. Augustine, Dear Lord, make me chaste, but not yet. There's laughter, but then Goldstein launches into a dead serious description of the various steps toward achieving the unshakable deliverance of mind, the cessation of craving without remainder. His description of the stages of enlightenment makes it sound like the most elaborate video game ever. The process starts when the meditator becomes super concentrated, when their NPMs reach epic velocity. It's like my backbird knee experience, only on steroids. You see things changing so quickly that nothing seems stable. The seemingly solid movie of the world breaks down to 24 frames per second. The universe is revealed to be a vast soup of causes and conditions. From there, the path, as Goldstein describes it, involves moments of terror, periods of sublime bliss, pitfalls, trap doors, and detours. At the end, the meditator arrives at the true goal of Buddhist meditation, to see that the self that we take to be the ridgepole of our lives is actually an illusion. The real superpower of meditation is not just to manage your ego more mindfully, but to see that the ego itself has no actual substance. Close your eyes and look for it, and you won't find any self you can put your finger on. So, for example, in my backbird knee jag, if I were more enlightened, I would have been able to see that not only is reality not as monolithic as it appears, but also the me who was noting all the arising objects isn't solid either. The strong, deeply entrenched reference point of I has been seen through, says Goldstein from the front of the room. That's Nibbana. The illusion of the self is, per the Buddhists, the wellspring of all of our negative emotions, specifically greed and hatred and confusion about the nature of reality, i.e. that we are much more than our egos, that we are connected to the whole. Once the self is seen as unreal, these emotions are uprooted from the mind, and the meditator becomes perfected. The mind goes from a monkey to a gazelle. Sounds awesome, I guess, but as he concludes, I realize that he hasn't answered some of my most basic questions. If it's so rare and hard to reach enlightenment, why bother trying? Is Goldstein himself enlightened? If not, on what basis does he believe in it? What do enlightened beings look like? Is nirvana slash nibbana a magical state? A place? Once I've achieved selflessness, do I then just return to my everyday life? Or do I no longer need to put my pants on in the morning? The Buddhists clearly figured out a workable, practical system for defanging the voice in the head. But to add on top of that, the promise of a magical transformation seems to me too cute by half. I buy the thesis that nothing in an unreliable, impermanent world can make you sustainably happy, but how will a quest for an enlightenment that almost no one can achieve do so either? When the talk is over, in a minor act of rebellion, I walk down to the dining hall and binge mindlessly on rice cakes. Day 9. In the morning question and answer session, Goldstein redeems himself with a little humor. In exhorting us to not tune out during these closing hours of the retreat, he says, "They're like the dessert, just maybe not the dessert you ordered." As he presses his case, he says something that bugs me. He urges us not to spend too much time thinking about the stuff we have to do when the retreat is over. It's a waste of time, he says. They're just thoughts. This provokes me to raise my hand for the first time. From the back of the echoey hall in full-on reporter mode, with my over-loud voice apparently not atrophied one bit from disuse, I ask, "How can you advise us not to worry about the things we have to do when we re-enter the world? If I miss my plane, that's a genuine problem. These are not just irrelevant thoughts." "Fair enough," he concedes, "but when you find yourself running through your trip to the airport for the 17th time, perhaps ask yourself the following question. Is this useful?" His answer is so smart, I involuntarily jolt back in my chair and smile. Is this useful? It's a simple, elegant corrective to my price of security motto. It's okay to worry, plot, and plan, he's saying, but only until it's not useful anymore. I spent the better part of my life trying to balance my penchant for maniacal overthinking with the desire for peace of mind. And here, with one little phrase, Goldstein has handed me what seems like a hugely constructive tool for taming this impulse without throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Achieving choiceless awareness and metta-induced blubbering may have been the most dramatic moments of the retreat, but this is unquestionably the most valuable. Day 10, I awake to the smell of freedom. Today is a half day. We do some meditation in the morning, and then we break silence. The zombies reanimate, transforming from the mindful walking dead back into normal human beings. You can almost see the color return to their cheeks. It's fascinating to engage with the people around whom I'd spun rather elaborate stories during the silence. Turns out they're totally normal. I have lunch with a handsome German woman who admits that she called her kids a couple of times. Also at the table is a middle-aged technology executive who says he came on a lark and largely enjoyed it. A young Asian guy approaches me. He's athletic and good-looking. In observing him over the past few days, I had assumed he would be stern and serious. Turns out he's super friendly. He tells me he felt privileged to be near me during that metta session when I cried. This produces a starburst of conflicting emotions, including gratitude and embarrassment. I mumble something and extricate myself. The teachers warned us that the real world would seem clangorous and jangly after 10 days of silence, but as I pull away from Spirit Rock in a cab, I turn on my BlackBerry and devour my email with more curiosity than dread. I visit my sister-in-law and enjoy being climbed on by her two young children. On the plane, I binge on TV shows on my iPhone. The habits of a lifetime reassert themselves with astonishing speed. It may have been one of, if not the, most meaningful experiences of my life, but I was nonetheless ready for it to end. Chapter 8, 10% Happier. I knew my television career had undergone a radical shift when I found myself reading the following line off the teleprompter. Now to the story of Irwin the Paralyzed Kangaroo. Cut to a live shot of a woman holding a handicapped marsupial dressed up in a shirt, tie, and vest. At which point I blurted out with forced jollity, "I like Irwin's new suit. He's looking dashing." I was smiling on screen, but inside my ego was hissing, "You are a dope." I was in the midst of an object lesson in the Buddhist concept of suffering, which in this case could be roughly translated into, "Be careful what you wish for." On a Friday afternoon, shortly after I'd come back from the retreat, a particularly chipper David Weston strolled into my office, stuck out his hand, and offered me the job as weekend co-anchor of Good Morning America. I was elated and relieved, lightheaded with glee. It was as if I'd totally forgotten all of Joseph's Dharma talks about the impossibility of lasting satisfaction. I felt as if months of worrying about my place in the news division and my future in the industry could finally cease. All of my problems were solved. Deliverance. What came next was a series of developments that could have been authored by the Buddha himself. 2 days after Weston strode into my office and confidently extended the offer, I was at home when I saw the following headline on the New York Times website. Chief of ABC News is resigning. When I got back into work the next morning, it was quickly made clear to me by various senior executives that Weston would be staying on as president for many more months and that the offer still stood. That meant it was time to negotiate my contract, which produced a whole fresh set of challenges. Talks quickly got bogged down over a variety of minor issues. Both sides dug in their heels. There came a moment when the entire thing appeared to be in jeopardy. After several weeks of stasis, in an attempt to break the impasse, the executive producer of GMA, Jim Murphy, called me in for a meeting. Murphy, everybody called him by his last name, had been EP for several years, during which time I had grown quite fond of him. He was a tall, nattily dressed guy with slicked back, salt and pepper hair, a soul patch, and a taste for cigarettes, booze, and sardonic humor. As I sat across from him in his corner office, which had a panoramic view of Lincoln Center, I was prepared for Murphy to try to convince me that I should drop my various demands. I expected him to make the case that these issues were really not as important as I was making them out to be. Instead, he chose a more aggressive tack. "Can I tell you something as a friend?" he asked. "Because I know," he said in his winning entre-nous way, "that you, unlike other people around here, won't get overly sensitive about it." "Sure," I said, shifting in my chair, trying to affect nonchalance. "You're never going to be the anchor of a major weekday newscast," he said, with a casual certainty that made my stomach drop. "You don't have the looks," he went on, "and your voice is too grating." He had me in a funny spot. Having coolly promised him that I could take whatever he had to say without getting too sensitive, I couldn't very well lash out as he killed my dreams. So I pretended not to be poleaxed as we wrapped up the meeting, and I limped out of his office. While my communication with my bosses was, to say the least, unsatisfying, I did meanwhile have a sudden epiphany about how to talk about meditation without looking like a freak. My disappearing on retreat for 10 days with no email or phone contact naturally provoked a lot of questions, which outed me as a meditator and forced me to discuss my new practice with a much wider group. At first, these conversations didn't go so well. At my family's annual summer pool party, just weeks after my time with Goldstein in California, my father pointedly told me a story about some people he knew who had discovered meditation and subsequently become, like, totally ineffective. Later, he warily asked me, "So are you a Buddhist now?" To which I muttered some sort of flustered non-answer. Among my broader group of friends and coworkers, the retreat spurred queries as skeptical as my father's. "You did what on your summer vacation?" they'd ask. The subtext always seemed to be, "So you've pretty much joined a cult, haven't you?" I could tell that people were thinking what I certainly would have been thinking if I were in their shoes, that I had become one of those people, the formerly normal guy who arrives at middle age and adopts some sort of strange spirituality. Whenever I was asked about meditation, I would either clam up and get a sheepish look on my face, the way dogs do in Manhattan when they're going to the bathroom on the street, or I would launch into an off-putting, overly emphatic lecture about the benefits of mindfulness, how it was actually a superpower, how it really wasn't as weird as everybody thought, and didn't involve clearing the mind, and so on. I could see the tinge of mild terror in my listener's eyes, the cornered interlocutor politely but frantically looking for any means of egress. There were a few things I was attempting, with varying degrees of ham-handedness, to achieve in these interchanges. Mostly, I was trying to defend my reputation to make sure people didn't think I was a loon. But there was something else. The more I meditated, the more I looked around and appreciated that we all have monkey minds, that everyone has their own weirs and mirrors they're competing against, their own manufactured balding crises, and, of course, the kinds of more serious collisions with impermanence from which I had mercifully been spared thus far. Especially after my powerful experiences on retreat, I felt compelled to share what I had learned. I just couldn't figure out how to do this effectively. At one point during a work meeting, for example, I mentioned to Barbara Walters that I was considering writing a book on mindfulness. She smiled and replied, "Don't quit your day job." After several weeks of this, I had a fateful conversation with my friend Chris, a senior producer at GMA. She'd been a mentor of mine since my earliest days at ABC. We had a no-holds-barred relationship, which usually consisted of her making fun of me for some on- or off-air foible. One day we were chatting at the GMA Rim when the subject of my recent vacation came up. She shot me a funny look and said, "What's with you and the whole meditation thing?" Trying to avoid another long, unsuccessful answer, I blurted out, "I do it because it makes me 10% happier." The look on her face instantly changed. What had been a tiny glimmer of scorn was suddenly transformed into an expression of genuine interest. "Really?" she said. "That sounds pretty good, actually." Boom. I'd found my shtick. 10% happier. It had the dual benefit of being catchy and true. It was the perfect answer, really, simultaneously counter-programming against the overpromising of the self-helpers, while also offering an attractive return on investment. It vaguely reminded me of the middling 1990s comedy Crazy People, in which Dudley Moore plays an ad exec who decides to start employing honesty in his taglines, coming up with such gems as "Volvos, yes, they are boxy, but they're safe," and "Jaguar, for men who'd like hand jobs from beautiful women they hardly know." His company sends him to an insane asylum. My new slogan also jibed nicely with a major behind-the-scenes ethos in TV news. Reporters, it was believed, should try never to oversell their stories. You don't want to go around telling the people who run the various shows that you've got the most amazing material in the world and then leave them underwhelmed. They'll never put you on the air again. Always best to provide room for upside surprise. Of course, you'd never know this by watching our product. On the air, we believe in the opposite of underselling. We slap exclusive labels on everything. I wished I'd had my 10% line at the ready when being questioned by my dad. I couldn't blame him for being skeptical, but now my new slogan was an effective kryptonite against this kind of wariness. As I started test driving it with others, it didn't create any on-the-spot converts, but it did at least appear to prevent people from thinking I had gone completely off the deep end. About a month or so after the retreat, I got the chance to test the slogan with Mr. Enlightenment himself. I had arranged to interview Joseph Goldstein for a new digital show on religion I'd started called Beliefs. On a sunny day in early September, he showed up at the ABC studios in his khakis and light blue dress shirt, wearing a BlackBerry holster attached to his belt. Outside of the retreat setting, he was looser and funnier, even charmingly goofy at times. We got along like a house on fire. I started the interview by asking how he discovered Buddhism in the first place. As a young man, he told me he'd been quite brash, very much in my own head, he said. He went to Columbia University with the idea of becoming an architect or a lawyer, but he ended up majoring in philosophy. He then joined the Peace Corps. East Africa had been his first choice, but karma being what it is, he was shipped off to Thailand, where he got his first exposure to Buddhism. He joined a discussion group for Westerners at a famous temple in Bangkok, in which he proved to be a controversial presence. "People stopped coming to the group because I came," he told me, laughing. "You've probably been to groups like that where there's that one person who doesn't shut up. That was me." Finally, one of the monks who was leading the group said, "Joseph, I think you should try meditating." So he did. Alone in his room, he set an alarm clock for 5 minutes and was instantly hooked. "I saw that there's actually a systematic way of becoming aware of one's own mind," he said. "It just seems so extraordinary to me. Before one is clued in, we're living our lives just basically acting out our conditioning and acting out our habit patterns, you know?" He was so excited that he started inviting his friends over to watch him meditate. "They didn't come back," he said, laughing. "So you were slightly insufferable," I said. Yes, slightly insufferable, but I think the meditation over the last 40 years has helped. After the Peace Corps, he moved to India for 7 years to study meditation. Eventually, by the mid-1970s, he decided to move back home to the United States, where he'd been writing books, teaching, and leading retreats ever since. On the subject of retreats, I asked, "Most people think 9 days of all vegetarian food, no talking, and 6 hours a day of silent meditation sounds like hell," he said, interrupting me with an utterly non-defensive chuckle. But he added, "When people do make the leap and attend a retreat, they get the first glimpse of what the mind is actually doing. You know, we're getting a real close, intimate look at what our lives are about." That notion really struck me. Until we look directly at our minds, we don't really know what our lives are about. "It's amazing," I said, "because everything we experience in this world goes through one filter, our minds, and we spend very little time bothering to see how it works." "Exactly. That's why once people get a taste of it, it's so completely fascinating, because really our life is the manifestation of our minds." With things going well, I figured this was the moment to float my new catchphrase. People ask me, if I dare to admit to them I meditate, "So is your life better?" And I like to say it's about 10% better. 10% is good for beginning a meditation practice. 10% is huge. I mean, if you got 10% of your money... "Yeah," I said, interrupting him, "it's a good return on your investment." "It's a good return," he said, "and it gets more. The return gets more and more." This turn in the conversation was perhaps inevitable. By the return on investment getting more and more, Joseph was, of course, signaling that one could not only be 10% happier, but also 100% happy. "I will admit," I said, "I remain skeptical about this notion of enlightenment. So I want to ask you, do you feel that you've achieved it?" "No," he said, but he very quickly went on to say something that surprised me. While he hadn't reached full enlightenment, the complete uprooting of greed, hatred, and delusion about the nature of reality, he was, he claimed, partway there. I'd read up on this issue a little bit since the retreat. According to the school of Buddhism to which Joseph belonged, there were many, I'd learned, there were 4 stages of enlightenment. The schema sounded like something out of Dungeons and Dragons. Someone who'd achieved the first stage of enlightenment was a stream enterer. This was followed by a once returner, a non-returner, and then a fully enlightened being known as an arhant. Each stage had 16 sublevels. "So you've achieved some of the early stages?" "Yes, and there's more work to be done." "How do you translate that into your daily life? When you start to lose your hair, or when somebody you love dies, or when your favorite baseball team starts to not be so good anymore, you don't suffer?" "I would say that the amount of suffering in those situations has diminished enormously. It's not that I have different feelings, but I don't identify and attach to them or make them a huge drama. You allow your emotions to come pass through with ease." "Are you not afraid of dying?" "One never knows until we're at that doorway, but right now I'm not." How was I supposed to compute this? Here I was, sitting across from a fiercely intelligent, self-deprecating guy who, like Mark Epstein, could easily have been one of my Jewish uncles. Nothing about this person screamed crazy. And yet he was telling me that not only did he believe in enlightenment, a seemingly fantastical transformation that denudes the mind of all of the things most of us believe make us human, but also that he was partway there. Was this some sort of affinity scam? Making things more confusing was the fact that even though enlightenment sounded about as realistic as my cats being able to control the weather, everything about Joseph's bearing signaled that he was, in fact, an uncommonly happy guy. I'm not sure exactly why, but this enlightenment thing really stuck in my craw. Maybe it was because it made me feel like my 10% solution was insufficient, or maybe it was because I couldn't reconcile my admiration for Joseph with the seemingly outlandish things he believed. Did those beliefs call into question the validity of the whole enterprise? If he really bought into enlightenment, could I take anything he said seriously? Fortunately, back at the office, I was able to shelve that theoretical 10% versus 100% debate and apply what I'd learned on retreat to the very practical challenges I was facing. I was, in fact, finding mindfulness to be extremely useful. After an initial period of how dare he indignation over Jim Murphy telling me I was never going to be a big-time anchorman, I decided to approach the problem in a Buddhist style, to lean into it, to take his views seriously, no matter how inconvenient they may have been, to respond rather than react. I forced myself to consider an unpleasant possibility. Maybe I was like a Shih Tzu who thinks he's a bull mastiff, a kitten who looks in the mirror and sees a lion. But no, I wasn't willing to fully concede, either to myself or anyone else, that Murphy's pessimistic forecast was accurate. Careers in TV news are too frequently influenced by factors like luck, timing, and executive-level caprice to ever really count anything out. However, the new mindful me, instead of automatically recoiling into denial or rage, was able to see that Murphy probably was trying to be helpful, although he was also undoubtedly aiming to put me in my place so I'd finally sign the damn contract. On that score, he succeeded. His unsolicited dose of career perspective helped persuade me to throw in the towel and close the deal. In signing, I told myself that at least now I would be able to officially make the jump to GMA, a job I was convinced would almost certainly propel my career in new and marvelous directions. Untethering myself from the rigid formalism of the evening news would, I believed, open up heretofore unseen vistas. As it turned out, being a morning TV host was not as easy as it looked. For 5 years on Sunday World News, I had been helming a true one-man show. 97% of what came out of my mouth was pre-scripted verbiage written by me and loaded into a teleprompter. When correspondents came on the show to do live shots, I knew in advance what they were going to say. In other words, there were very few surprises. Now I would be part of a cast of four, including a female co-host, a newsreader, and a meteorologist, all of whom were free to say whatever they wanted whenever they wanted. This loss of control created some interesting challenges. GMA was structured in a way that was loaded with opportunities for ad-libbing right from the minute we went on the air. That was the point of it, really. The audience wanted to see the hosts interacting spontaneously. The very first thing we did after the open of the show, the pre-produced part where you see snippets of the morning's big stories and then the Good Morning America animation, was called the Hellos, during which we would greet the viewers and preview a few of the other stories coming up that morning. Our lines were written into the prompter, but mostly that was just a guide. We were supposed to be having a conversation. However, when the chatter went down a verbal tributary for which I wasn't prepared, I would sometimes find myself tensing up, nervously shuffling my papers, or letting out a forced Ed McMahon-style belly laugh. This was frustrating for me. Off camera, I was usually able to diffuse situations with humor. Part of what was holding me back now was the dawning realization that the jokes that came naturally to me were often better suited to a late-night cable show than to morning television. Basic logistical questions could also be tricky. How do you sit on a couch, where we did some of the lighter segments toward the end of the broadcast, without slouching or spreading your legs too widely? How do you smoothly extricate the group from conversations when the producers were screaming in your earpiece that we were running out of time to hit the commercial break? No one gave me the memo. There was also the challenge of adjusting to the content of the show. I'd been around morning television for a while, so I knew when I accepted the job that we'd be peddling softer fare than the evening news. I also considered myself an info omnivore who enjoyed crime and pop culture empty calories along with my nutritious hard news. Nonetheless, I would sometimes find myself outside my professional comfort zone. Playing judge in a live weigh-in contest to determine which chihuahua was the world's smallest, competing in a gingerbread house-making contest with my fellow anchors, and the coup de grace, dancing on live television with a box on my head, dressed up like the Shufflebot from the hip-hop band LMFAO. Fortunately, Nightline and World News continued to provide me with opportunities to do work that put me firmly back in my comfort zone. Wanbo and I did a piece where we interviewed evangelical pastors, whose faces and voices we agreed to alter in order to protect their identities, who had secretly become atheists but hadn't yet ginned up the courage to tell their flocks. I confronted Governor Jan Brewer of Arizona about her refusal to set free an elderly convicted killer, even after her own clemency board unanimously recommended his sentence be commuted. I surprised the governor by bringing the inmate's son to a news conference. The two of us fired questions at her in tandem. She fled pretty quickly. Most significantly, I did a full half hour on Nightline about the saga of an 18-year-old boy I'd met in Iraq and helped move to America to attend college. Much as the Bush administration had naively believed that Americans would be greeted as liberators after the invasion, I had assumed this young man, who ironically was also called Dan, a Kurdish name, would thrive upon arrival here. I had grown very attached to him, and when he got kicked out of school for misbehavior, I spent several years and an enormous amount of emotional energy trying to get him straightened out, only to be frustrated at every turn by his adolescent intransigence. I recorded every twist of this running drama, shooting much of it myself on a small camera. I couldn't help but view Dan's actions through the lens of the Buddhist concept of suffering. He was never satisfied where he was. He always assumed that the next big life change would solve all of his problems. Ultimately, to my profound disappointment, he ended up moving back to Iraq, a decision he regretted immediately. Back on Weekend GMA, I was discovering that the gig did have some upsides. Notwithstanding my occasional stiffness, our little team was getting nice feedback. Our colleagues and bosses gushed about how we had good chemistry. I really liked the other members of the on-air team. My female co-host was a lovely young woman of Moldovan descent named Biana Golodriga. We had known and liked each other for several years before she became my TV wife. The similarity of her name to that of my real-life wife was a bit delicate, though. On my first official day on the job, I said, "I am now permanently one consonant away from destruction." The newsreader was Ron Claiborne, a dryly funny former print reporter. At first, we had a rotating cast of weather people until the bosses hired a vivacious young meteorologist from Chicago named Ginger Z. Z is a shortening of her real and awesome last name, Zeitgeist. I also started to appreciate that even though the morning audience was smaller than the evening audience, the relationship with the viewers was much more intimate and intense, the result of the fact that the format was looser and more personal. Morning TV, I came to see, was a potent way to convey useful and important information. Being in people's living rooms and bedrooms as they prepared for their day and discussing current events in a more casual manner had a unique impact. Perhaps even more powerful at times than the intoning from the mountaintop nature of evening news. I felt enormously lucky to have the job. The intimacy with the audience was, however, a double-edged sword. While I enjoyed the opportunity to chat with viewers via Facebook and Twitter, as a broadcaster you're always curious about people who watch, I couldn't help but notice that people felt free to share their opinions about me in ways that an evening news anchor rarely endures. I kept a file in which I saved some of my favorite messages in their original uncorrected form. "Will you please unbutton your jacket? You look uncomfortable. Please, please, please tell Dan to sit squarely at the desk and quit leaning to his right, the viewer's left, toward Biana. It is so distracting. Make Dan go away, please. Just thought I would let you know that your tie doesn't look centered. It almost looks crooked. Don, you have a hair out of place that is making you look like alfalfa. Please do me a favor. Slow the blank down and stop trying to take over the show. It makes you look like a major clown. You should really DVR GMA and listen to yourself. As you give the news and the story is of a serious nature, you shouldn't sound happy. I was, in fact, DVRing myself, and my criticism of my own performance was much harsher than anything the viewers had to offer. I was not a fan of the guy I saw on television enthusing about the waistcoated kangaroo. This was where meditation really paid off. Post-retreat, I was up to 30 minutes a day. Every morning, I would scan my calendar to figure out when I was going to be able to fit in work, meditation, exercise, and spending time with Bianca. Some afternoons, I'd bang out my 30 minutes on my office couch as I awaited script approval from World News or whichever show had assigned me a story. I didn't necessarily look forward to sitting. In fact, the first thought to pop into my head after I'd shut my eyes was usually, how the hell am I going to do this for a half hour? But then I'd see the thought for what it was, just a thought. I rarely missed a day, and when I did, I would feel not only guilty, but also less mindful. When I got tense about work, I would watch how it was manifesting in my body, the buzzing in my chest, my earlobes getting hot, the heaviness in my head. Investigating and labeling my feelings really did put them in perspective. They seemed much less solid. The rain routine plus Joseph's "Is this useful?" mantra almost always helped me snap out of it. But while meditation made me more resilient, it certainly was not a cure-all. First, it didn't magically make me looser on GMA. Second, while I was recovering more quickly, it didn't seem to prevent all churning. On some weekend mornings, I walked out of our studios haunted by Irwin the kangaroo. On one such day, I left the office and headed downtown for brunch with Mark Epstein. In the 2 years since I'd met him, we had become genuine friends. He and his wife, a talented and successful artist named Arlene, had been to our apartment for dinner, Bianca and I had been to their airy downtown loft, and also met their two grown children. When I went to spend time with Mark solo, Bianca, who adored the guy, was just a tiny bit jealous. I tried to orchestrate a get-together once every 2 or 3 months. Usually, it would be brunch after one of my weekend GMA shifts and before Mark headed upstate to the country house where Arlene had her studio. I'd be the only one in the restaurant wearing a suit. On this morning, having long since branched out from the Tribeca Grand, we were meeting at one of our regular spots, Mirandi, an Italian bistro in the West Village. I arrived with a list of items in the questions for Mark file in my BlackBerry. Chief among them, even though I was rebounding more quickly, were my self-recriminations over my job performance a sign that I was somehow a JV meditator? Should mindfulness be more effective at extinguishing this kind of thing? I asked, how would I accurately describe how meditation is helping me here? It's just allowing me to step back and watch it all happen nanoseconds at a time, and through that process, it takes some of the fangs out of it? Yes, he said. It's not going to make it go away, I said. No, it might help it make it go away a little quicker. It might, he said, his head shaking slightly as he carefully chose his words. To the extent that it loosens the way you would ordinarily be caught by how terrible this all is, it might loosen your own attachment to whatever melodrama is unfolding. My remedy these days combines some things that are non-meditative, I said. I think to myself, so if this whole thing blows up, what's the worst case scenario? I lose my job? I still have my wife who loves me, and the only person who can ruin that is me. It works, but it has nothing to do with meditation. No, that's insight. As he spoke, his voice rose an octave with insistence. Insight into the nature of reality, I asked sarcastically. Yeah, he said, not taking the bait. That's insight because you're not clinging to success so seriously. But maybe I'm just clinging to Bianca. That's better. You're clinging to something that's far more substantial. As I sat there mulling Mark's words while wolfing overpriced eggs, my new 10% happier slogan began to make even more sense. It was a reminder of the message Mark had delivered a year ago when I was unsure about whether David Weston was going to give me the GMA promotion. Back then, at our Tribeca Grand Beer Summit, Mark had helped me see that the point of getting behind the waterfall wasn't to magically solve all of your problems, only to handle them better by creating space between stimulus and response. It was about mitigation, not alleviation. Even after decades of practice, Mark, who, unlike Joseph, made no claims to any level of enlightenment, told me, "I still suffer like a normal person." When I asked him what kind of suffering was most common for him, he said something about dealing with self-pity, but didn't elaborate. Moreover, I could now see how the mitigation Mark was pitching had real-world consequences. For example, it allowed me to acknowledge my performance issues rather than pretend they didn't exist. Perhaps most important, it made me easier to live with. Bianca said she couldn't remember the last time I'd walked into the apartment scowling, even when I'd had a particularly tough day. Her only beef was that she had to tiptoe around the apartment if I was meditating in the bedroom. While she was a believer in the potential of meditation, she was not doing that much herself. On those occasions when I saw her stressed about work, it took restraint not to recommend that she start her own practice. I was pretty sure, though, that proselytizing would make her want to throttle me and that the smarter play was just to listen sympathetically. Much as it had been with my Iraqi friend Dan, it was illuminating to view my own struggles as a morning show host through the lens of suffering. In a world characterized by impermanence, where all of our pleasures are fleeting, I had subconsciously assumed that if only I could get the weekend GMA gig, I would achieve bulletproof satisfaction, and I was shocked when it didn't work out that way. This, as Joseph had pointed out on retreat, is the lie we tell ourselves our whole lives. As soon as we get the next meal, party, vacation, sexual encounter, as soon as we get married, get a promotion, get to the airport, check in, get through security, and consume a bouquet of Auntie Anne's cinnamon sugar sticks, we'll feel really good. But as soon as we find ourselves in the airport gate area, having ingested 470 calories worth of sugar and fat before dinner, we don't bother to examine the lie that fuels our lives. We tell ourselves we'll sleep it off, take a run, eat a healthy breakfast, and then, finally, everything will be complete. We live so much of our lives pushed forward by these if-only thoughts, and yet the itch remains. The pursuit of happiness becomes the source of our unhappiness. Joseph always said that seeing the reality of suffering inclines the mind toward liberation. Maybe, but all the Enlightenment talk continued to feel totally theoretical and unattainable, if not downright ridiculous. Here in the real world, people like me, who the Buddha called unenlightened worldlings, had to pursue happiness as evanescent as it might be. As I hugged Mark goodbye and walked toward the subway, I confidently told myself that I was squeezing everything humanly possible out of the meditative superpower. However, as I was about to learn, there were practical down-to-earth applications I hadn't even considered yet. They were being put into practice by people who would never wear shawls and dangly earrings, and for reasons that would both deeply impress me and fully put to rest any residual embarrassment I might have had about being a meditator. Chapter 9. The New Caffeine. Retarded. That was how Private First Class Jason Lindemann, a 20-something with a high and tight haircut and a permanently amused look on his face, described his first impression of meditation. "The first time they had us do it," he told me, "I thought, oh man, here we go." PFC Lindemann and I were talking in a dusty corner of the sprawling Camp Pendleton Marine Base in Southern California. "So no part of you thought this could in any way be useful?" I asked. With zero hesitation, he said, "No." Lindemann was an involuntary subject in a multi-million-dollar scientific study requested by the Marine Corps brass. The military's interest in a practice that was seemingly anathema to the world of warfare was fueled by an explosion of science. Forget the blood pressure study that had made me willing to try meditation in the first place. This new research was on the next level. It was creating some surprising converts, previously hardened skeptics who were now employing mindfulness in ways that would revolutionize my approach to work and drive a stake through the heart of the assumption that meditation made you, like, totally ineffective. On my travels to various Buddhist seminars, I had started to hear mentions of scientific research into meditation. It sounded promising, so I checked it out. What I found blew my mind. Meditation, once part of the counterculture, had now fully entered the science.